My name is Brian. I'm from Taylorsville. And the fact that I won't be broadcast to millions is something I'm perfectly comfortable with because I appreciate talking to you two gentlemen. In 2009, I discovered Facebook. By the spring of 2010, I was at the first high school reunion I ever attended in 30 years, mainly because of the contacts I made with Facebook. In the years since that 2010 reunion, I've come to the conclusion that both leading up to the reunion, at the reunion itself, and in the years since, all the people that were my friends are still my friends, and the people that were idiots and boobs in high school indeed were that virtually, in reality, and in every way. And so my point in telling you this personal story is that I wonder if what we're observing about what we find out about ourselves with our interaction with the computer is not that it's changing us, it's just magnifying the reality of who we've always been for all eternity. The vast majority of the populace of the planet are scatterbrained, unable to focus, unable to really get it all together because they can't think critically. And that there's a small minority of people who are really the leaders. Socrates said it, Plato's Republic, there's different divisions of people. And so here we are, it's nothing new.
To me that emphasizes the danger that I see. That if you assume that the ability to think deeply, the ability to concentrate, to be attentive is actually a rare quality, then you want to do everything possible to protect it, to encourage it, to make sure that people who are capable of thinking in that way actually learn to think that way and actually are encouraged to think that way. And what we've done with our technology is create a world in which it's harder and harder to engage in those kinds of thinking. So even people who might naturally have that ability get less and less opportunity and less encouragement to learn those kind of skills. And what becomes rare to begin with then becomes rarer and rarer still.
Over here.
Mr. Carr, I'm Vince Trollen from Hickory. I was curious about your thoughts on and knowledge of, does this technology drive human behavior, or does human behavior drive this technology?
I think both. I mean, certainly the internet, you know, didn't come down to us out of the sky. It's something we created and we shaped, and the reason we use it so much is because it's so useful. And often enjoyable. So nobody's forcing us to use the technology. It is in a fundamental way, and this is true of all technologies, an expression of a certain set of human desires. On the other hand, once you create the technology, and you see this over and over again, we mentioned the clock earlier, you see it with maps, you see it with pretty much any telephones, any technology you can imagine, once it becomes popular and spreads throughout society, it does shape people's behavior. And not always in a way that people think about. You know, we didn't sit down and say, well, we're going to invent the automobile because we want to live in suburbs. We invented the automobile because we wanted to get around quicker than on a horse. And yet then we ended up living in suburbs, and that might be good or bad, but it shows how technologies that are developed for one reason can have all sorts of unintended consequences and really shape the way we behave, even though originally they are very much emanations of our desire to control and shape the world around us through our tools.
Over here.
Hi, I'm Bill Young. I'm from Gastonia. I'm a student here at Lenoir Ryan. And I was wondering, do you believe that with what the internet is doing to our brains, it would be possible for, over the years, to become more difficult for humans to do things like handwrite and have face-to-face conversations with other people?
Well, handwriting is Certainly.
It's gone.
And I say this with a great deal of sadness from my own life, but boy, trying to write in script these days is kind of a strange challenge. And in fact, you see schools just stopping teaching it because they think, you know, kids are just going to communicate with their thumbs, which is probably true. So there are some things that, and this has always, again, always been true of technologies, there are some human skills and human capacities that just are made redundant by the technology, and I think that'll be true here. Face-to-face, you know, communication, and in other words, conversations, certainly there's a deep desire in people to socialize, and that goes beyond socializing through computer screens and email. And so I don't think it's going to disappear. There may be some people may become so kind of used to communicating through screens and with their thumbs that they lose some of their skills to communicate face-to-face, and I think that's probably going on right now, but I don't think that's going away from society.
When my niece went to college last year, my brother called me to say she's having a really tough first week. It'd be neat if you would call her. So I did, and she had nothing to say to me. I kept prodding her, what's wrong? Nothing to say. So I said, well, okay, I'm here if you want to talk. Bye.
Well, she answered the phone. That's amazing.
3 minutes later, the texts begin. And it went on for 45 minutes. I didn't know how to make it stop. So what's that all about? She couldn't talk to me, but she could do this.
You know, one of the most amazing changes that's happened in the last 10 years is that telephones have gone from being voice technologies to being word processing technologies. Much more communication goes on via text today, going actually against what Marshall McLuhan said, but that's another story. And, you know, I think there's various reasons for that. One is that it's simpler to communicate via bursts of text because you can have lots of conversations with different people in different places simultaneously, and you don't really have to worry about people being there. On the other hand, there's also kind of an insidious side to this. And this is something that there's a book that came out last year, I think, called Alone Together by an MIT professor. She got into this, that a lot of kids use text rather than face-to-face communication or even voice calls to reduce their social risk. If you have a conversation face-to-face with somebody, and to a lesser degree, if you have it, you know, an immediate conversation with, you know, over the phone with your voice, there's some social risk. You don't know what the other person's going to say. You don't know if something uncomfortable might come up. If you do it by text, you distance yourself from those kind of social risks. On the other hand, you lose a lot of the richness of communication,
but
which all depends on.
I brought that up because I think that points to his question that he asked a second ago. I mean, that we are balkanizing. We're all by ourselves on our little computers now.
Yes.
Only listening to what we want to listen to.
There is a lot of that.
I don't care what you say.
Going on. One thing. I'm going to text my reply to you. We do tend to, one thing psychologists know about us is that we tend to seek out information that confirms our existing biases. So when you give people the internet, you know, the assumption is, we're going to all go out and look at diverse information and counter points of view and, you know, and come to this, you know, synthesize all this information and become smarter. What we all do is we go out and just gather all sorts of information that reconfirms what we already believe, and that makes us believe that even stronger, become more extreme in our beliefs. And there is this balkanization effect that happens because this natural desire to seek out information that supports what we already believe. And there's a lot of that going on. You can see it in a lot of areas in society, I think.
Okay. Over here. We do care what you think, so come on.
I'm Jean from Hickory. I prefer the face-to-face contact type of thing. I don't do computers. And everywhere I go in Hickory, I talk with people. And it's a funny thing. We get into great conversations, people I don't even know. Regarding this business of evolution and adaptation, I would remind people of the little froggy in the bowl or in the pot where the water's nice and comfortable. And then it gets a little warmer, a little warmer. Finally, he decides, ow, I'm in trouble. Too late, sorry. And the other thing is, I feel like computers and technology are really the puppeteers, and the guys that use them are the puppets. And I would remind you that your Britannica on the internet is eminently hackable. So I wouldn't necessarily trust what was on there. And all I can say is, people, learn to speak with other people, to watch them, to listen to them. Internationally, if we can't do this, we're doomed. When we decide how to spend our tax dollars, how to interact with people in other nations, if we don't know how to sit down and talk, we are doomed. I'm sorry. I wish I had something happy to say. But this was fascinating, and I thank you.
Thank you. Let's go over here.
My name is Lee Gibbs, and I'm from Hickory. And I do have a question. I'm going to start with an assumption, which is always dangerous. And if I'm wrong, correct me. But I'm going to assume that you would agree to the statement that there's a linear correlation between the internet and its use and all the information and to the rise of diagnoses of ADD in our society. And I was wondering if you would go so far as to saying there's cause and effect between those two things.
So the question is the relationship between the internet and diagnoses of ADHD.
Yes.
I personally wouldn't go so far as to say there's a cause and effect, and it's not because I would say there isn't. It's just that I don't think the evidence is clear enough yet that there's a cause and effect between those two things, and I think they're both complicated things. On the other hand, I do think that there's now evidence that what appears to be one of the causes of attention deficit types of disorders is a person's inability to control their working memory, which is your short-term memory where you're taking in information moment by moment. And it's your conscious mind, basically. In that, which is called cognitive overload, you can't control it, and so you're overloaded with incoming information that you can't control. And that seems to be a very similar state to what we experience often when we're online. We're overloading our short-term memory, and as a result, we become even more distracted because we can't even remember what we're supposed to be concentrating on. So there seems to be an underlying correlation there between the states of mind that you see in attention deficit situations and the states of mind that are often what we experience when we're online. So, but going from there to cause and effect, from what I've seen, and I'm speaking here as a layman, I haven't seen what I would consider to be proof that there's a cause and effect there.
What have been scientists' reaction to this book and what you talk about in the book?
Similar to the general reactions, which have spanned the entire spectrum of responses that you can imagine. So,
but are there people working on what you're talking about here scientifically to see if it holds water?
Yes. I mean, there have been people working on this subject for a long time,
okay.
And I kind of review some of the science that we know up till now. But it tends to be, and this is often the case with psychological studies, even brain scan studies, it tends to be very narrowly focused experiments because it's hard to... it's hard to broaden out these experiments and say, how does a particular technology influence the quality of a person's thought? Because you have to, in order to do that, you have to see how the person would have thought without the technology, and it becomes very complicated. So there certainly are lots of studies ongoing about the effects of interruptions that come at us through screens, multitasking, even the effects of putting links into text. And so my guess is that there's going to be, over the next 10 years, considerably more evidence, one way or the other, either supporting me or not supporting me. But my guess is we're at the kind of beginning of a lot of research into this.
I think we have six more people, and we're really short on time, but I'm going to... What should I do here? Let's go over here.
Good evening. My name's Levi Dennis. I'm a student here at LR, and my question to you tonight is about sleeping. Through my lifetime, which hasn't been that long, but through my family and friends, I can see that they'll stay up till 1, 2, 3 o'clock in the morning on their computer or their tablet or their cell phone, texting and sending emails and Facebooking and Googling. And it seems to me that they have a harder time going to sleep at night. Do you think that this could have a correlation with the data overload they're getting through the internet?
I can say with some confidence that spending a lot of time online right before you go to bed is not the best way to get a good night's sleep. I mean, there's no doubt that that kind of stimulation, and if you've done it, you probably know it. You know, anytime you, particularly if you're exchanging messages and so forth, if you're socializing, because then when you go to bed, you have to rehearse everything you've done to, you know, as we always do after we socialize. I think there's no question that you know, gadgets and screens and stuff are probably harming the quality of our sleep. And I have to say that if only based on my own experience, I can say that that's not a good thing for your mental life.
We've also had people on the show who've said that sitting in front of a bright screen, whether it's your iPad or your computer or a television, an hour before bedtime, it stimulates the production of it suppresses the production of the chemical that makes you want to go to sleep. So, cortisol, is that what it is?
Melatonin.
See how well I listen to my guest?
Hi, my name's Stephanie Bertrand. I'm a senior at Hickory High School. You were talking about how technology today is rewiring our cognitive circuits, especially in today's youth. How do you think that future societies, especially in today's youth, will be affected as a whole, especially with this new influx of, or with this great influx of new technologies?
Well, I think what we've discovered about what scientists call neuroplasticity is that our brains adapt, and they adapt at a physical level to our environment, which isn't really surprising. We've always known that was true for kids up until the age of 20, but what's become clear is that goes throughout our adulthood, and our brains basically adapt to the way we use them. So if we train ourselves, as I think we are, to be constantly distracted, to be constantly multitasking, to always have divided attention, then that's the state that our brains will be best at and will feel most natural to us. And as a result, you know, we may be very comfortable in that way of thinking, but what you lose is the ability to engage in more attentive ways of thinking, the ability to sustain a train of thought for a long period of time, and I think that's what the technology is doing. And I would guess that we'll, unless something changes in the technology or the way we use it, we'll continue on that path, and more people will think in little bursts of information and attention, and fewer will actually be able to concentrate.
Do you think that it would call for a revolutionized system in education?
I'm not. my belief is, particularly in younger ages, is that a lot of parents and a lot of school boards and a lot of schools make the assumption that because we live in a highly computerized society, we should push computers into schools and use computers more and more. My own belief is that schools need to be a refuge from the technology, a place where kids can learn different ways of thinking. Which is not to say that they should be banned from schools, but that they should be used carefully.
I'm getting this, which either means stop or I have something on my neck. I don't know. But since we started with Stephen Colbert, let me end with Stephen Colbert, because this is how he summed up his conversation with you on his show. He said, the internet is preparing us for the coming apocalypse that it is helping to bring on. It gives and takes at the same time. Now, he was being funny, but that's a pretty accurate summation of that book, isn't it?
I think so. And you failed to mention when he pulled out his iPhone and started fiddling with it during the interview. But yeah, I mean, I'm not sure I'd go so far as to say it's preparing for us for the apocalypse it's bringing on, but it's certainly changing us in ways that suit its capabilities, not necessarily our own.
I know there's still people who want to talk, so if you want to talk, filter down here because it's over. Nicholas Carr, thank you for being here.
Thanks, Mike.